This recording features Leslie Ito, Executive Director of the Armory Center for the Arts in Pasadena, California. Here, she's talking to a group of high school teachers and students about her family's history. She opens by telling a story about her great-grandfather, who migrated to the United States from Japan before World War II.
I share all of this because I feel like it's a part of me. It's why I give back to the community. It's in my DNA. And I think it helps to share what happens to him and his family later. My great-grandmother comes via Seattle and as a picture bride. They're matchmaking at that time, and I think they go to send word back to Japan that he's looking for a wife, and they send a wife to him, and that's how they form this union. It's called being a picture bride. At some point, they're in Denver, they make their way to Los Angeles, and they have, I think, five children, and my great-grandfather was at the time what they call a houseboy. He worked in a family's home, and my great-grandmother was a cook, and the children were helpers around the house. And then I think they gathered enough to start a business, and they had a florist shop, flower shop, off of Alvarado by MacArthur Park in downtown LA. And then they moved to Santa Ana and opened a nursery there. And that's where they were in 1942 when Executive Order 9066 happened. So I brought this to share. You've probably seen this. My husband and I found this in a thrift shop or antique shop in San Diego. And we collect antiques, and we're excited to find this. So I have it framed. You can pass it around. It's, yeah. And so 9066 happened. I think all of you have been studying that, so you know about that. But for my particular family, they were in Santa Ana. Their church that they belonged to was in right by USC, Centenary Methodist Church. And they weren't sure what was gonna happen to them or where they were gonna go, but they knew that they wanted to keep the family together, and they wanted to stay with their the congregation at their church. So they sold off everything from the nursery as fast as they could. They packed all of their stuff, and they moved back to Los Angeles at that time so that they could be evacuated with the community that they felt closest to. Interestingly enough, their church, they stored a bunch of their personal belongings at the church, in the basement of the church. And they, because they could only take two bags each of their personal belongings. So the rest of their stuff they stored in the basement of the church. And I actually have quite a few family photos from pre-war time, which is really unusual for families to actually have in their possession. And it was because the church, while the Japanese Americans were incarcerated, an African-American community came and looked after all of the contents that were in the basement. And that church actually still exists right now. It's Holman Church, which is actually known as one of the most progressive African-American churches in Los Angeles right now. So they're active in a lot of civil rights issues and things like that. So I feel like that history and that connection is really interesting. And the Japanese Americans had but there were pockets of allies in the Latino and African American churches and communities. And the other church that was really helpful to stand up for Japanese Americans were the Quakers. So the American Friends Service Committee helped, were really the ones that were vocal about standing up for the civil rights of Japanese Americans on the outside. And it's part of what my family, my research at UCLA and at Mount Holyoke was about this movement of high school students that were becoming college students in the camps, and the Quakers were helping them on the outside to find colleges that would accept enrollment of Japanese Americans. So they worked with the government to help the high school students get released in order to go to college. But they couldn't go to college on the West Coast because there was still this executive order in session. So Japanese Americans couldn't be free on the West Coast. So the Quakers helped find colleges, mostly private colleges, in the Midwest and the East Coast, where the students could be released into sort of the custody of these colleges. And that's actually where I had learned that at the college that Seven I went to, Mount Holyoke College, which was a small women's college in Western Massachusetts, there were three women that were released from the camps and enrolled at Mount Holyoke. And so I, that's where I started my research on this topic. And I was specifically looking at women. And this was one of the reasons why the government agreed to release these college students, is that they knew that at this time it was like 44, 45, they knew that they were gonna start to release the Japanese Americans back into society. But they weren't sure how the reception was going to be. So they were using the student it's called the student relocation movement. They were using the student relocation movement to test it out in these small college towns. So these students were there to start their future, to get an education, and they didn't know, but they were also being like tested in these communities. So my thesis was about how these students became ambassadors, cultural ambassadors, to these tiny little towns in the Midwest and the East Coast. And you know, I think for the most part, you know, they encountered some racism, but I think for the most part in these small college towns, the reception was good, and they were kind of being protected by these Quaker communities as well. I brought some photos of myself. This one is of me and my great-grandfather. He lived to be 103, and he's probably like in his late 90s in this photo. This is of me and my grandma, and I think some neighbors that they had. But I wanted to also share with you this family heirloom, and you can pick it up. I just discovered that I think it used to have, this bird used to have legs because there's two little holes there. It probably had sticks for legs. But this is a pin that my great grandfather made in the camps. You know, they were there, and you know, they had to figure out ways to stay positive, to keep themselves busy, and a lot of them turned to arts and crafts and sports. They tried to keep their culture alive in the camps. So this is a example of some of the crafts that they did. My great-grandfather made this. They foraged materials from the natural landscape, and he made this pin in camp, which was something that is not unique. It's representative of some of the arts and culture that was happening in the camps. My grandma was 16 when they were rounded up and taken to the camps. Their first stop was at San Anita racetracks. And on my dad's side, their first stop was the Pomona Fairgrounds. And it's interesting because, you know, it's a place that we go to. You know, the mall is there, the racetracks, but they were actually, they lived in the horse stalls. But as I mentioned, my grandma was 16, and she was a typical teenager. They didn't know where they were being sent to, right? They knew they were told to be prepared for all kinds of climate. So my great-grandfather sent her downtown with some money and told her to go buy boots because they were preparing for all kinds of weather. And she came back, she took the streetcar downtown, and she came back with these high heel boots. She was 16, she was like a fashionista and like really boy crazy, and she came back with these high heel boots, and she got in so much trouble. My great-grandfather like sent her back, and she had to go and like buy like actual like rugged boots. And so, you know, my grandma, her experience, she would always tell us that her experience, she had fun in camp because she was a teenager. Her parents knew she couldn't get into too much trouble because she was within these grounds. But she also recognized that that her parents were really the ones that that suffered the most, lost everything, their livelihoods. It was, you know, many of them went into a deep depression because they just didn't know. They had worked so hard all of their lives, and suddenly they were, you know, unjustly accused of things that they had no idea, were, you know, just didn't know what to do with themselves. And I think as a fourth generation Japanese American, I've been thinking a lot about how intergenerational trauma is passed down. And sorry, I've been thinking about it, but I haven't really talked about it in a group, with a group, but I think I look at the current state of my family, and I think that our communication style and the way that we handle difficult times have been affected by our experience. And I think that it isn't uncommon for current immigrants and refugees, and the things that we have, that our ancestors have sacrificed to ensure that, you know, we can sit in this classroom and have these conversations about democracy and free speech and, you know, living the lives that, and having the opportunities that we have today. So I've been thinking a lot about that, how to use the arts for healing and to tell our stories, and also for healing. It's really important to me, and it's actually why I've gotten into the arts, is to empower our communities to not forget history, but also, I think more recently, coming out of the pandemic, thinking about how arts and culture can play a role in healing, because we need it to, we're gonna need it to pass down the generations and heal through everything that we've been through in the last three years as well. So for my family, you know, my grandma, as I said, her stories are, you know, she had fun in camp. There were, you know, she had access to all these boys. Post in Arizona was the largest camp out of all of the camps, and so there were, and it spanned like miles and miles. There were two camps, so she lived in Poston 1, which was referred to as Poston 1, and my grandpa lived in Poston 2, and according to her, that's where all the cute boys lived. It was in Poston 2, so she used to walk all the way to Poston 2, and they would have like school dances and things like that. But my grandma, like education-wise, because of the wartime and the age that she was when it happened, she went to 5 high schools in that span of the 4 years of high school. So it was very disruptive to her education. But a lot of Japanese American families, we didn't talk about this experience. It was too painful, and it was something that they just wanted to forget. So it wasn't until the social movements, the Asian, what we refer to as the Asian American movement, started in the 60s, and it was after we learned from sort of carrying on from the African American civil rights movement. Asian Americans decided, like, oh, that we also have a social movement and a history that we shouldn't forget, and also, you know, our rights have also been violated. So, Visual Communications, which is an Asian American media arts organization founded in 1970, was part of that movement, and they were really active in trying to. They were really one of the first to tell the Japanese American internment history. And I was the executive director for about a little over 4 years. And during that time, we produced this video, Stand Up for Justice, a story about Ralph Lazo, who was a Mexican American teenager who all of his friends were Japanese American. He went to Belmont High School, and he actually went to Manzanar Camp with his Japanese American friends. He was one. I think there was a few white women who also went to camp because they had multi-ethnic families who were also incarcerated. So I thought we would look at the first 5 minutes of the Ralph Lazo clip. I did share with Seba the link, and then we also created curriculum, high school curriculum, to go with it. So it was about 20 years ago. It might be a little bit dated, but I hope that it's helpful. I think the way that especially media functions, you know, is really powerful because it helps us to understand each other's histories. And, you know, in my family, my grandparents, they didn't share too much with us. I remember my grandma taking us to a film screening by Visual Communications about the camp experience. And that was kind of her way, less painful way for her personally, for her to educate my sister and I, her grandchildren, about our family history. So again, this is really why I feel so passionately about the arts and the impact that it can make in people's lives.
I'm an art teacher. I really appreciate bringing objects because it embodies a story. And the question that I have is for you and also for the students, because it takes some level of openness and work to like share your story. Mm-hmm. It's not easy, and I know that many of our students might have stories like that in their families. And my question is, how can we accelerate like that feeling of being able, feeling comfortable, empowered to share their stories? What has been your road?
Well, I think my work and my current work at the Armory, we talk a lot about how do we create not just safe spaces for creativity and storytelling, but courageous spaces. So you're right, it takes, you know, you have to feel okay with being vulnerable to share your story, but there's so much to gain from hearing, from sharing, and also hearing each other's stories. You know, right now we're in a time where, you know, there's lots of talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion. And what I've really been trying to push in our organization is, you know, we can have diversity trainings and all of that stuff, but actually, really, if we can get to a place of feeling safe enough to share our own stories, that's where we're going to learn about each other, about culture, different cultures and communities, is really by learning about each other's stories and finding both the things that are different, but also the human connections that we have with each other as well. And I think artists can play a role in this as well, of ways to think creatively about how we tell each of our stories.
I think I want to point out the part of inclusivity and the way that the father in the film kind of dismissed the son's idea of supporting the family because, you know, they were Japanese. And it was like, Dad, it happened to us already. So telling those stories through whichever way we want to tell the stories, but in the sense of being inclusive of others. It's like, if it happened to me, and we hear this, right? We tell ourselves all the time, if it happened to you, it could happen to me as well. But when it actually came the time to be supportive of each other, it wasn't really happening. And of course, he kept on mentioning, oh, the government. But ultimately, I think, you know, we hold the power when it comes to that. Yes, the government has a lot of power. However, being inclusive of others and listening to each other's stories, as different as they are, we have to be aware that there's a lot of similarities. And so being inclusive of others.
Yeah, and I think it's also why projects like this are so important, because this happened 75 years ago, but we need to keep this history and talking about this history and contextualizing it in the current day. We have to keep that alive. So the funding that that you all received to support this work is a part of that that work, and it is part of the policy making of keeping all of this alive. So I think it's the California state funded, and it's also the funding that I received to do my research about the student relocation. I also received the same funding. When 9/11 happened, it had a really big impact on me because I knew that we had, as a Japanese American community, we always said, we won't let this happen ever again. And I felt like when 9/11 happened, it was really putting our feet to the fire. Like, okay, what are we gonna do? And because here's a situation, we're feeling the hysteria, the fear mongering. And so there was an organization that was born out of that era called Vigilant Love. And it's the Japanese American and the Muslim American communities coming together during that time to fight Islamophobia together because of our past history as well. So that work is really important to me. So we continue to see it, which I think is why learning this history is really important.
Just to go back on, like, I think one of your family members took out money to buy farmland. Mm. I think one of the things that stood out to me when we were exploring this with our students last year, and also I read about it and then learned it from a tour guide at the Japanese American Museum. He was explaining how Japanese farming techniques were brought over to the farmland in California, and that they yielded more crops and more harvests in a smaller plot of land than Anglo-American farmers, and that gave them an edge and economic success here. And that was resisted. I forget the specific name of the association of farmers, but it was taken like to courts, and they were trying to resist like the economic prosperity of the Japanese Americans because they ended up taking the edge over the farming industry. And to me, that stood out to me the most because those techniques were like cultivated and produced over thousands of years in Japan, and that was brought over and gave them an edge.
Yeah, and actually, so back to our alma mater, Mount Holyoke, there was one of the three Japanese American women that was released from camp and went to Mount Holyoke was Michi Weglin. And Michi Weglin is really important in the movement for reparations and redress for Japanese Americans because she went to the National Archives and did all this research and found documentation that said the camps didn't happen because of national security, but because it was an economic issue that they were trying to hold back, stop the economic gains that Japanese Americans were making, the farmers were making.
Last year for my class, we only read like Jonas's part. That was when he was like a little kid and how he like grew up. But with your side, it was a little more different since it was like they were more older, and
Okay. This is one more family story for all of the pet lovers group. Because what happened with our family pets, right? We had to, you know, leave everything behind. So my grandma said that she had a dog, family, like a beloved family member, furry family member, and the neighbor took care of it and actually brought it to the camp to visit them. Actually drove to Poston and brought the dog to visit. Yeah. As a dog lover, I appreciated that story.
I have a question for you, and this is something that I've noticed. I mean, I come from a family of dislocation also because of partition. My family had to move from India into Pakistan, and that history is broken. But we talk about it all the time. And what I have noticed is that Dr. Kodama spoke, you know, back in January, February. I remember you saying, oh, I don't talk about this very much. And then you said, we don't talk about this very much. And I'm very struck by that because this is such a deep part of U.S. history.
Yeah.
And so what creates that sort of wall between having an open conversation and saying, yeah, I am a survivor. My family is a survivor. This is what we went through.
I mean, it's definitely rooted in Japanese culture to like suppress the feelings and just keep moving ahead. I think most of it is rooted in that. But I think there's also, I think there's shame because they have internalized that experience. Even though they, you know, they did nothing wrong, I feel like there was some kind of shame entangled in that as well. I don't know. Dr. Kodama, do you have...
No, I absolutely agree that there's a cultural component, and that especially the Issei and the Nisei really didn't want to discuss their personal experiences. It was more of a shikata ganai, yeah. Right? You know, it can't be helped. And so why focus on that? You know, in my family in particular, I didn't even know that my grandfather was in the 522nd and, you know, liberated a concentration camp until shortly before, you know, he passed. And then he wanted to kind of open up about that. But, you know, I really do see that cultural component as the major factor on why it's not something that, you know, is still discussed to this day.
Yeah. What camps were your family in?
Started in Manzanar and ended up in Tule Lick. So my great-grandfather was a Nono boy.
With the Nono boys, is it your grandfather that was sent and the rest of the family stayed at Manzanar? Or
no, the
whole family.
The family went along, and then my grandfather and his brother were drafted. And so that's how they ended up in the 522nd. No, boys, there were two questions that were given to all men of age in the camps. And it was, would you forswear any allegiance to Japan, and will you fight in the army? And my great-grandfather felt that that was kind of a trap, right? It was at a time during the war that they did not know who would win. And so the thinking of the No-No boys was, well, if they prevail, we're going to be executed. If they don't prevail, we're still not citizens of this country. And so I think, again, never having discussed that openly, that would be my presumption on their part.
Yeah, it was also referred to as like the loyalty.
Yeah, the loyalty oath, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I led the JCCC, as Seba said, and there were times when, I think every year on December 7th, the attack on Pearl Harbor, I would think about, like, if that had happened today, I would have been part of that first group to be rounded up, because I was a community leader and so closely tied to Japanese culture. I've thought also about the loss of language. So many Japanese Americans stopped speaking Japanese because there's this push for super patriotism and really proving yourself to be American. So that's sort of where the breakdown was. And I really am sad, I regret. I think there's still time to learn, but have lost that language. And so over time, I've also thought that my work in arts and culture, and particularly Japanese arts and culture, is an act of resistance in a way, because we were stripped of stripped of the ability to speak the language or practice the culture in order to prove ourselves American. So to bring that back and try to teach the next generations the language and the culture is to undo some of that.
How can we bring the Armory has, including you, to our students?
I would so open to ideas. I would love to, we're here to connect and serve when and how we can. I've been at the Armory 5 years, and I'm really trying to shift us. We used to be like, this is the box, this is the thing that we can do and we think is good for you. Here it is, do you want it at your school? And I'm trying to get away from that model and really embrace a model of, you tell us, what do your students want? Let's work together to brainstorm ideas, write grants together. So I would love to sit down with you and talk more about how we can dream up something and support you. I've come for senior defense a couple times, and I love it, it's so fun. I'm so impressed by all the students here. It's so inspiring.